over the next 1 hour, 50 minutes, I'm going to be taking you through some of the elements specifically relating, in terms of comparative media histories, to what many people have actually defined as the dark side. And I'd say incorrectly, but then again, as programme leader for public relations, you might well say, of course he would. We're going to find out a few interesting factoids along the way, such as why did bacon become so popular as a breakfast menu? Apologies to vegans and so on. We're also going to find out how Julius Caesar and Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair have all in various ways been interconnected with respect to public relations. And we'll begin to set the scene for what I'll be talking about next week, which is propaganda. Other bonuses that will be coming through in this session will include the official handouts that Jane's instructed me to pass on to your good self, which has all your details about when and when you're doing your presentations. I'll be talking about that again more next week. And we'll also talk a bit more in the second part, after I've done the initial lecture, about what you think about public relations and so on, and how it kind of connects together. Allowing for the fact that an awful lot of journalists actually end up in public relations posts. In fact, I was speaking to a graduate this morning who's working for a very important PR company in London. I think it's well worth being apprised of the kind of skill sets that are used in both. And certainly in terms of the title of this module of comparative media history, there are a lot of similarities that come through with respect to this. And certainly when we start talking about stories and other issues as well. Just a little heads up, in terms of the slides that you're going to see, they're all on Blackboard. I know, because I put them there this morning. In addition to that, I'll hopefully have a podcast of the lecture as well available for download. So don't go crazy about making notes unless I specifically say that these are key points you need to be aware of and so on. Okay? Does that make sense to everybody? Yay! Okay. So let's start off, as you would start off all good essays, of course, with a definition. And we'll talk about a definition from a gentleman who is American, but in many ways he's referred to as the father of this thing we call public relation. And he's a gentleman called Edward Bernays, who was highly influential in terms of the public relations industry, way up until basically passed on, really, in the last century, but certainly for the first five or six decades of the 20th century, he was the go-to person in terms of really understanding what do we actually mean by this generic term PR. The interconnectedness between the public and the people who want to make opinions or shape opinions or change opinions. And I think that's the sort of areas that come out of that particular quote there. To inform people, to persuade people, and we also see this in terms of nudge theory and so on. I mean, the bacon example, which I'm going to use in a few moments, is particularly interesting because, of course, these days, you have a bacon sandwich, it's like having four cigarettes, one after the other. It's a disaster. Complete switch in terms of lights. And actually, cigarette smoking itself has been through both sides of the continuum. It's been through the notion of being, it's the ideal treatment for nerves. You should always have lots of cigarettes before you do any presentation. No! To, it's a cancer stick. Okay? So you've got lots of changes and things within that. And then, of course, you've got that other final part of that little quote, which is the integration of systems and people and aspects relating to that. Sometimes PR or propaganda is used to effectively disconnect people. And that's something, again, we'll start looking at when we start exploring propaganda and how it really emerged in the First World War and then continued to sort of permeate itself right through the present day and so on. But I talked about where did PR actually start, where did it actually begin, where did it come from? And you might say, well, of course, he's just said Edward Bernays. No, actually, dial back 2,000 years and beyond that, 4,000 years. Because this whole notion of what we call writing, journalism, media and so on really actually ties back to, as it says there, pretty much 1800 before the birth of Christ. So you're talking, as say, little over 3,800 years from where we are at present. And what was it all about? Well, it was passing on information. Information that was going to be of benefit to the citizens. It was demonstrating how the farmers could effectively improve their productivity by using things like irrigation and so on. So it was a mixture of ensuring that that nudge theory of changing a population to do the kind of things that you're looking for them to do was being put into production, and as a result of that, it's a win-win situation. So not the dark side at all. It's not a case of manipulating facts. It's quite simply an example of how, you know, from the pharaohs of Egypt, right the way through to the rulers, the leaders, to your average farmer, in an agrarian culture, you're really demonstrating the benefits of how PR can be developed. Move forward a couple of hundred years, and there's a gentleman, one or two you may have actually heard of. And what was Caesar's line? Well, he was an ambitious soul. It wasn't just a case of suddenly he found himself emperor of Rome and the Caesar, leader of all Caesars, and obviously aiming to, a few centuries later, actually have an English playwright called Shakespeare write a play all about him. No. He was very much an example of a politician who had a game plan. And what he actually used to do in order to pave the way was make sure people wrote about him. Because if people don't write about you, you don't know. Hence that line, there's no such thing as bad publicity. Put your hands up if you watch the song for your Eurovision on Friday. Yay, well done. Did you think the right song actually won?
I mean, they were all a bit corrupt.
Yeah, well, yes, but I would have gone for Freaks, personally. I thought that was far better, and I think the one that actually did win was up there. But the message that was being given out to all the contestants was, make sure your message gets put out there. I presume everybody will obviously be tuned into the Eurovision Song Contest, which will be the first post-Brexit Eurovision Song Contest, perceivably, this year, because it is quite outstanding in its own way. Back to Julius Caesar. Not that he ever entered the Eurovision Song Contest, at least I don't think so, because we didn't have television in those days. But he did very much use the mass medium of the day to start talking about his Gallic Wars. And the term epic was being used. What a wonderful person he actually was, keeping the Gauls, the French, under control. And as governor of Gaul, he was very much at the heart of that whole thing. And these were messages which were being sent back, but a message to Rome, to the Roman Empire, and so on and so forth. They were all propaganda. He produced a daily paper which actually continued for 400 years after his death. Translates as literally daily acts. And that early sort of notion of promoting a message via the whole notion of diaries, newspapers, and so on, is there. Not newspapers necessarily as we currently refer to them, not in the kind of post-1700 era of the Times and so on. Indeed, probably we're saying now that the demise of newspapers, we're heading back to those Babylonian clay tablets, different kind of tablet, of course. But you're still talking about getting messages out there, promoting messages and developing commentaries and so on from that point of view. I can already sense somebody thinking, Lord, if he's already just into the Roman Empire and he's trying to fit it all into 1 hour 50 minutes, it's going to be a hell of a sort of compressed thing. And you're right, so we have to move up slightly further to the onset of the War of Independence, which of course came to a crux in 1776. But 3 years before that, there is a classic example of what you can still recognise, and Edward Bernays would recognise now, as being this is your ideal photo shoot slash opportunity, because cameras obviously hadn't been invented then. But the whole opportunity and the line to actually ensure that things were being promoted. You know, what was it? A bunch of Bostonian citizens effectively threw a lot of tea boxes into the sea because they refused to pay any tea taxes or any taxes that the government in Britain was trying to actually enforce upon them. No taxation without representation. Why would they? They were a colony. Why should they kind of feed all their money back to Britain to support various other bits and pieces? But it captured people's imaginations. It gathered that whole notion of a big stunt, so your journalists would report on it, package would be reported on, the whole sense of the media routines would be there, and it was completely fabricated. It wasn't a spontaneous action. It was put together with the same kind of methodology that you use if you're kind of promoting Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as the kind of the light side to Jose Mourinho. Although, obviously, being a City fan, I really don't care what's happening there. Anyway. Moving on from the success of the War of Independence, you find that Washington and the founding fathers of America, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Mann, and other folk, would use every form of media to get their message across. And in that Revolutionary War, so you can see there, 8 years it sort of lasted, you would have newspapers being used. This is where newspapers really start being developed as a mass production. Pamphlets would be used. You'd have public oratory. People would actually go and actually talk about various other bits and pieces. You'd have town meetings. So you're getting the first indication of what is clearly a mass campaign. It's addressing all of these kind of things in a way that kind of starts really getting people's message across, that actually liberty, equality, fraternity, taken from the French Revolution, the whole notion of the Declaration of Independence, human rights, independence, and so on, was very much at the heart of this thing. You can see similar things, although we haven't gone to war as yet, with respect to the Scottish Nationalist Party, with respect to, obviously, the Brexiteers, and so on and so forth. Same kind of rhetoric comes through. Take back control. We've got our country back, etc., etc. All the sort of messages are being applied and utilised. Except in this case, it wasn't a case of America getting its country back, because that would have been the Native Americans who would have got their country back, and they haven't really managed to develop their particular promotional thing as yet. There's a very good example of an initial political cartoon, which, if you actually start looking at these particular things, obviously it's a snake, all connected together, but you've got New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Virginia, you've got the sort of just literally the codes and the states of the American thing, and the line, the message that's coming across, very simple, very basic, using the media, it's like an early Instagram, really. Join or die. United we stand, divided we fall. So again, simple messages being used to kind of impact in terms of the message that's putting out there. If you are a citizen of Pennsylvania or Virginia or New Jersey or New York and so on, you're thinking, well, actually, we're better in this group fighting against the British people than we are without them, etc. Maybe those kind of messages can get things across. Particularly if you've got a population which may not be fully literate. You know, again, if you haven't got people who can cope with reading lots of details and information, then you want a simple, basic message that you can actually tap into. Symbols are very important aspects of all political campaigns. And I'll give you a couple of seconds just to actually read the sort of message that we've put up there in terms of the line of things. Clearly, the American colonists felt that the Stamp Act was unfair, unjust, and problematic. And the very fact that they would gather under a large elm tree to protest that means that they start using the elm tree itself as a symbol of protest and defiance. You never can tell quite what is going to catch on as a symbol-ish. You know, back in the early Christian church, it was a symbol of the fish. You know, there are all sorts of other areas that come through in terms of how code is used and developed to effectively acknowledge that people are part of a shared connection in terms of what they're looking for and so on. But again, that whole notion, which again, the liberty tree in its very name, freedom, liberty, tree, growth, expanding from that sort of point of view, is one way of actually raising two fingers to the British government, George III, and so on. So all of these things are kind of falling into place in terms of how we're seeing them being used and so on. Move up a little bit further to when America's obviously got its independence, the British have gone, and so on, and the only way British people can be part of America is actually join the country, emigrate to the United States of America, become part of that United States of America. It's a hell of a big country. Huge. How do you actually connect New York East Coast with California West Coast? especially when you've got a large range of states in between, and effectively you've got horses and basically horse-drawn carriages and so on to get folk over there, covered wagons and so on. How do you actually work through that process, given that there are still challenges with the Native American souls and so on and so forth? Well, actually, one of the things was, let's drive it by technology. Let's get people to buy that technology. You know, buy your smart mobile phone, buy your latest incarnation. Let's buy into this notion of the railway. Cast your mind back, way back to Reporting Continuity and Change, when I was talking about the Industrial Revolution and how the railroad and the telegraph were absolutely essential developments to open up the notion of speed in terms of the way that stories actually got from place to place, and also the way in which reporting would actually take place as well. So they started to work through that. But there's still that notion of, it's a very expensive way to get from one part of a continent to the other, to build a railroad. It needs to be funded. So what are they actually doing? Well, first of all, you've got a goal, and you've got, there's gold in them thar hills. You know, California had a gold rush that was actually there from that point of view. If you make your way over these thousands of miles, get to California, you will make your fortune. America very much pushing the notion of land where dreams can come true, particularly if you're white and male, less so if you're non-white or female, in which case you got lots of problems, but that's another issue for another time. But you're still talking about, how do you develop that process? And so you get a whole range of guidebooks being published, which will talk about how it's a relatively straightforward process to actually get from one point to the other. The rewards are huge and massive, and there are ways of actually investing in the railroads to travel. That way, the railroad companies get more money, the individual farmlands, etc., effectively start having to cope with the responses of that, and so you begin to open up the whole new frontier using that technology. I wonder what possible things could be applied to that today. HS2 perhaps? Come back to that. But again, the same sort of notion. Look at the kind of rhetoric that's being put together in terms of how successful and why we should just slice open a whole chunk of the country, because HS2 is going to be essential to get to Dover, to get to, probably anywhere else other than Europe. Etc. So same sort of messages we put together. And that's just a relatively small part. I mean, in comparison to the railway, that's teeny. But at the same time, it's still a significant. And even a slightly earlier, the sort of arguments that were put together for the Channel Tunnel, why that was an important strategic way forward from that point of view. So you're seeing public relations being used not only as a way of kind of raising awareness, but also as a way of driving people's desires and dreams in terms of an area that effectively works and functions. There's an example, okay? A slice, and what's the colour? Exactly. You know, you've got a colourful gold thing, an account of California and the wonderful gold regions. A new arrival at the gold diggings with a description of the different routes to California. Information about the country and the ancient and modern discoveries of gold, how to test precious metals, accounts of gold hunters, together with much other useful reading for those going to California or having friends there. Do you know, I was invited to a wedding in Los Angeles on Sunday, Phil Dearness and Lily Holliman, who I think you've spoken to on the radio, various other bits and pieces. Tragically, I can't go because I'm teaching here going on the Monday. However, I'll be there in spirit. But again, in terms of that whole notion of pushing the world out there, and obviously you've got your kind of classic image there, new arrival at the gold diggings, cartoons of obviously people going to. There's a movie which, if you haven't seen it, is a wonderful example of the California gold rush. It's called Paint Your Wagon. I don't know if you've ever encountered that. It's got Lee Marvin singing, Wandering Star, amongst others, but it really does, certainly in the opening, even the opening 15 minutes, worth downloading from YouTube, or probably is on Netflix as well, Paint Your Wagon, and it kind of really captures that rush for gold and drive for gold that's at the heart of this whole thing. So it's tapping into, you know, human beings' greed, if you like, human beings' propensity to actually get something for nothing. can't be bad, etc. Free lunches. Talk about free lunch. Anybody see Hugh Jackman in The Greatest Showman? Can't believe you're not seeing Eurovision and The Greatest Showman. What's happened to you guys? Okay. Anyway, The Greatest Showman, which was very much the story of P.T. Barnum, who many folk would actually say was the 19th century's showman supreme. He would sell tickets for flea circuses. He would get people to actually go and see these wonderful performing fleas, and if they couldn't actually sort of, you know, people said, well, they can't, you just couldn't see them. They're so tiny and small, the little fleas, that they were performing in their own way. A stack of things from that point of view. This particular image that we've actually got there, where he actually had a trip to London, you have this, again, huge sort of notion of the giant elephant jumbo skeletal structures, obviously in an era where people are looking at the dinosaurs and other areas within that whole field. And I think his quote there that I've put up is well worth spending a few seconds on. If I am ever profoundly thankful for any instrumentalities, it is for the editor and his paper. They furnish the wind for my sails. It's very much a exercise in jointly mutual beneficial partnership. The newspapers will benefit in terms of sales, in terms of the wow factor. You know, giant P.T. Barnum, great, the Great London Circus, etc., combined with a whole range of other things. You know, great jumbo skeleton. I'll be devastated if the answer to this next one is nothing, but hands up if you're going to be going and looking forward to go see the live-action version of Dumbo later on this year. You mean you won't believe that an elephant can fly? Okay. Oh, well, I'll try and get over it. I blame Brian Winston. Anyway, moving on to the sort of line there. We've also got in Barnum's line there that he knew the publicity value of stunts and faked events. Fake news. Ooh, has it been going around for some time? Yeah, it has, actually. But it depends how it's applied and how it's used. Sometimes something which is completely fabricated and fictitious has the benefit of getting people talking. Again, that line, the only thing worse than bad publicity is no publicity. That at least if people are talking about you, whether you're Tim Witherspoon, whether you're Nigel Farage, whether you're Boris Johnson, whether you're Theresa May, whether you're etc., is people not talking about you. Getting into that whole line of wondering, okay, you know, nobody knows. If nobody knows, then nobody will go. And if you're in the business of show, that's problematic because you are looking to make money. So you need to feed into that system. In the same way as if you're a politician looking to actually get elected, you've also got to generate some sort of interest in line, whether that's through social media, whether that's through traditional promotional aspects or whatever. You're still looking at getting those messages across and addressing them accordingly. There's another example of the late 19th century of somebody who actually many people think was genuinely real. And there was a kind of Buffalo Bill. Just as we can say now, if we look at the early 20th century, there is genuinely a Spider-Man in New York City, because obviously we've seen the movies, so it must be somebody who was bitten by a radioactive spider, or indeed several people were bitten by a radioactive spider and taken into the Spider-Verse and so on. But Buffalo Bill, as you can see there in terms of the cartoon strip that was developed, again, was very much an icon who was developed in the role of basically promoting a whole range of issues about the Wild West. This is where we get the whole notion of what the Wild West is. This is what Hollywood effectively builds an entire genre on, in terms of the Wild West, the outlaws, the cowboys and Indians, all of that mythology, those urban mythologies, emerge from this whole process. And if you've got not only a Wild West hero that's actually there, put together by John Burke, as you can see, who also has lots of fictional stories written about him. It's the same reason, put your hands up if you think Sherlock Holmes is real. Oh, he wasn't. as a fictional character, unless you believe in the cosmological theory of physicists that actually one reality's fiction is another person's reality and so on. But no. But at the same time, you still permeate the culture through the notion of how things are going. And that's where we start talking about public relations as a form that can really hype up aspects. Use hyperbole to begin to open up a whole range of other elements as well. As I say, you have got Marvel superheroes on road trips on various other bits and pieces. Busted. Well, they must be superheroes because they've got another album out. Hey, any Busted fans here? I'm batting zero for zero here, obviously, anyway. Work our way through it. Okay. I suspect you would have huge issues if you tried to use that particular image or promo, and quite rightly so, today. But, again, in terms of staged events, same sort of stage event that actually a couple of hundred years earlier had resulted in the Boston Tea Party. Here was a situation where a soap manufacturer wanted to promote its product. So what they actually did was they sent a 14-foot sailing boat to Spain to commemorate Columbus's 400th anniversary to America. Even though, of course, he thought he was actually finding a voyage to China, and effectively it was Amerigo Vespucci who discovered America. And actually, it was not even America. The only reason Amerigo kind of claimed America, and America was named after Amerigo Vespucci, was because the Vikings had a purely oral culture. And the Vikings had gone to America, and because they actually just, their history was purely oral, they didn't write the things down, so they didn't have any sort of reference or notion that they had actually been there long before the rest of us. But, as you can see, the message that's come across, where it's using humour after a fashion in the end of the 19th century, and it's using the whole notion of a brand to actually get the message out there. Sapolio. The most important thing, quite clearly, is the brand's name, Sapolio. The rest of the stuff, it's hopefully there to keep it memorable. Think of jingles, think of idents, think of Go Compare. Think of the meerkats. You must like the meerkats. Think about 2-4 Orange Wednesdays. All slogans that blur the boundary between, is this advertising? Is this marketing? Is this news? Again, they're all media forms that coalesce together to form the message, so you're left actually to go away with that kind of image and impressions actually there. Has anybody seen the Jennifer Lawrence advert for Dior, where she hurls herself into swimming pools and so on? Yeah. You might sort of think, oh, Jennifer Lawrence, she's gone on since the Hunger Games or whatever. She's working for, but again, you sort of come across with the notion of what is the brand there? Celebrity endorsement, ultimately. That's what it's all about. And if you think Paul Scholes is worth £400,000 a week for Juventus? That's his. Sorry? No, it's you. Thank you. Yes, see, obviously, Paul Scholes is in charge of Oldham. Well done. Well, you were paying attention. Good. Yeah, Paul Scholes, manager of Oldham, probably not getting £400,000 a week. I make that quite clear. Aaron Ramsey, Juventus Turin, is getting £400,000 a week, allegedly. Anyway, just a minor point. But when you're doing presentations, if you want to drop in some random football facts, feel free to do so. I might add a few extra points on for that whole thing. Anyway, talk more about that next time. Okay, let's move back to the last century. So we're approaching the 21st century and we're beginning to work our way through this. The first ever press agency, entitled the Publicity Review, was founded in Boston in 1900 by George Michaelis. Nothing to do with George Michael, in case you're sort of thinking, as no, absolutely not, but George Michaelis, who actually sort of put the first press agency together. Followed very shortly by the opening up of the first public relations department by William Wolfe Smith, about 2 years later. And then, seeing that it's a good thing, 2 years after that, two individuals who again we'll speak of more in this session and later, were both responsible for setting up Parker and Lee in 1984. In other words, a way of having an agency which could interface between the client and between the public. And that client may be political, it may be commercial, it may be actually less so to be voluntary, but it would certainly sort of echo those key things. And then, as I mentioned, after the Great War, because obviously we didn't know it was World War I there, Edward Louis Bernays set up his public relations office in 1919. And that's kind of where we sort of move on to Lee and Bernays and so on. And I'll give you a few seconds to actually consider those particular aspects, because these are fundamental statements at the heart of that very pejorative phrase that I started this lecture off by saying that public relations is the dark side of journalism. It's the one which is untrue. It's not good. It's involved with manipulation. I've put a link, as I say, on Blackboard to a PDF file that you can download, which is about sort of 8 pages in length, which talks a bit more about Chomsky's view of manufacturing consent and how the history of public relations is seen. And this quote, journalists seem to treat public relations and its practitioners with contempt. Strong words. Again, why that connects together. Well, Lee very much had that belief that ultimately you need to tell the truth, because if you don't, it's going to come back and bite you. It's not just George Washington who allegedly said he couldn't tell a lie, he cut down the cherry tree. He did genuinely feel that that was the case. And that's one of the reasons why when the manure hits the fan and organisations are running around thinking, what the heck are we going to do? Lee is generally acknowledged as the person who kind of tells you, how do you deal with crisis management? How do you deal with issues where journalists might have uncovered a story that perhaps you don't want to reveal in terms of the public eye, that are problematic about the whole thing? Reverse of that is Edward Bernays, who effectively starts talking about, as Chomsky would say, Noam Chomsky, the manufacture of consent, or the engineering of consent. The notion that if you repeat something often enough, people will eventually start buying into it. Psychoanalysis. How do people respond to different colours, different moods, different approaches? What's the best way forward? Is it a case of an image of Lord Kitchener saying, your country wants you, pointing at the assembled crowds and so on? Is it a case of how you're developing that? Is it a case of shaming people into connecting with other things? Is it a case of nudge theory? How do you actually get people to change, you know, in terms of, you know, aspects? I mean, even now, Hollywood's hashtag Me Too, trying to actually get 4% of all films next year to be made by female directors. What, really? Is that so ambitious? But still, looking at that sort of system. And he went on to say, Bernays, that actually, this was an essential part of democracy. You had to persuade people to follow your particular way of thinking. Otherwise, you were going to have challenges. You're going to have, you know, problems that people wouldn't understand. But the role of a democracy is to always question the status quo. So, pop quiz question. Who invented, quote unquote, bacon and eggs for breakfast? It was indeed. Straight in there. Why did he do it? Because a company wanted to sell more bacon. Quite simple, you know. And what did he actually do? What was his technique? Well, you can see it there. Sorry, yes. You know, he basically used science, quote unquote, and psychologists to say, actually, if you want to really do well in life, you want to succeed, a bit like that. Those people who did Orange is the Modern Britain with me last year. Do you remember the Kellogg's advert I showed you? Where the man goes off to work and he kind of says, thank you, Beth. Good, excellent. I thought it would be indelible thing. It's using the kind of message that actually you need to have a good breakfast to start the day with. And then, if you tie in that with the notion of, well, bacon and eggs is a hearty breakfast, you're getting association. And things work, you know, when we teach, when we work through all sorts of processes, you're building associative links. It's how the human mind works. We remember things because we connect the most bizarre images together. And if you connect those two things together, a bit like, say, £350 million per year to Europe, let's give it to the NHS, you can connect that. Even though there's no real truth in it, but you're still working on that whole premise of how things are working and operating. We're also seeing in the period of Bernays the growth not only of the film industry, newsreels, but also radio. In other words, mass media is developing. And if you link a radio campaign to a newspaper campaign and in-store promotion, it's a win-win situation. It's a rule of three. That if you see three different forms of media still promoting the same message, you're going to start responding to that whole key thing. As indeed, celebrity advertising notwithstanding, this will hopefully demonstrate.
And so that there's this real
not quite like that. Stop that.
The early 20s, the New York Times did the creation of chains and department stores across the country. They were to be the outlets for the mass. They were to be the outlets for the mass. Bernays' jobs was to produce the new type of customers to produce. Bernays began to create many of the techniques of mass consumer persuasion that we now live with. He was employed by William Randolph Hearst to promote his new women's magazines. And Bernays glamorized them by placing articles and advertisements that linked products made by others of his clients to famous film stars like Clara Bow, who was also his client. Bernays also began the practice of product placement in the movies. And he dressed the stars at the film's premieres with clothes and jewelry from other firms he represented. He employed psychologists to issue reports that said products were good for you, and then pretended they were independent studies. He organized fashion shows in department stores and paid celebrities to repeat the new and essential message. You bought things not just for need, but to express your inner sense of yourself to others.
There's a psychology of dress. Have you ever thought about it? How it can express your character? We all have interesting characters, but some of them are all hidden. I wonder why you all want to dress always the same, with the same hats and the same coats. I'm sure all of you are interesting and have wonderful things about you, but looking at you in the street, you all look so much the same. And that's why I'm talking to you about the psychology of dress. Try and express yourselves better in your dress.
In 1927, an American journalist wrote, "A change has come over our democracy. It is called consumptionism. The American citizen's first importance to his country is now no longer that of citizen, but that of consumer."
He was uniquely knowledgeable about how people in large numbers are going to react to products and ideas and so on.
Okay. Right. Back to that. Okay. Selective timing. Timing is everything when you look at campaigns. Making sure you get the perfect storm of aspect, desire, things that are being selected, chosen, and if you can endorse that, as we saw there, in terms of fashion by various other things, again, things become memorable. Now, I mean, you might well say, but isn't this a very cynical manipulation of the audience? Isn't this something where actually, you know, it kind of does away with our ability to discern when we're being sold bad news and so on? Well, there's a gentleman who clearly didn't believe that, because he also would actively use sporting endorsements to promote his particular products. Famous Henry Ford line, "You can have any colour you wish as long as it's black." And actually responsible for the whole notion of Fordism, the development of the mass production line, the notion that rather than actually handcrafting your particular automobile model, you would actually mass produce something. But you'd also make that mass product something that was desirable, that was encouraged and so on, very much from the point of view of attracting other people to listen to it. I mean, again, the line that's actually Henry Ford made a life work of the development of the automobile and presented to the world the car so perfected that the success of the Ford Motor Company is without a parallel in the automobile industry. Lots of things interconnect with respect to that. We'll just have a quick look at, again, some of the sporting stars that he used to address that as well, hopefully without the additional echo that comes through. Or maybe with. Here we are.
999 is a great car because...
Oh, don't do this.
It's an original Henry Ford-built racer, and it's one of the two cars that we have that were built to race during his in-between years when he's trying to find his footing between his first failed attempts at building a car company and then his final success with Ford Motor Company in 1983. 999 was built in 1902, 1 year after Sweepstakes, which is when he first sort of established his name. His first company, Detroit Automobile Company, had gone belly up, so he started his next company, the Henry Ford Company, after the success with 999, because that generated some more interest. Henry Ford actually did not race in the 999 because he reached a point with that car where it was almost too fast, too powerful for him. He was too scared to race it. So they came up with another fellow, Barney Oldfield, at the time was a bicycle racer, never driven a car before. But they somehow induced him to take a try at 999, and he was a natural at it. He just got in there, kind of gunned it, drove around the track at high speeds, and did really well, and launched a career for himself. Really became the U.S.'s first big racing hero. 999 is about brute force. That's what I think of when I see that car, because even Sweepstakes has kind of a curved, nice round body to it. There's no body of any sort on 999. It's just the engine sitting on top of a wood frame with the driver in the back. And a couple of interesting things about it. It does not have a steering wheel. It's got a big kind of T-shaped tiller that the driver steers by and slides back and forth. And it's also got no transmission available. What's actually for transmission is just the flywheel, and then it's got a wood block clutch. So you move a lever and it extends the wood clutches against the flywheel, almost like the drums in a brake. It's got a massive engine in terms of displacement. It's just four cylinders, but it's something like 1,154 cubic inches. Barney Oldfield was able to take it up to 60 miles an hour on the track, which was a mile a minute. And that was kind of the original land speed barrier, if people thought of it as the sound barrier. No one would ever get that fast, no one could ever break that speed.
And that's one of the reasons why Lewis Hamilton with Formula One and various other drivers can obviously generate so much interest in terms of their own particular aspects of racing and so on, because it interconnects together. So, bacon sandwiches, eggs, hearty breakfasts, politicians, the public as consumers, railway tracks, political campaigns, all very much at the fore of this whole system of how public relations is being used and developed. Have we heard of the Rolling Stones? Glad you said yes, Jesse, otherwise we'd be most concerned there. Good. Would have thought, it's not Jesse, it must be something completely different. Yeah, very much this whole notion of getting a brand image, getting something that even if you've never even listened to a Mick Jagger, a rated number, you still have a flavour for the kind of aspects that the Stones actually have. And not just did we actually have this Sticky Fingers look, but also that whole image that comes through in terms of logo, where you're going through, and so on. I mean, as Egan's actually saying, the design, Pasha's design, became the most famous logo for a time in the history of popular music. So again, you're looking at permeating a whole variety of different cultural aspects and elements. Certainly in terms of politics, Saatchi & Saatchi were the PR company responsible for the enormously long queue, which has emerged in various ways ever since then, which back in 1978-79 led to this young lady from Grantham effectively becoming Prime Minister and setting up a whole range of individual cultures and so on. But it's very much addressing that whole side of things of quick, clear, simple messages that people understand. Three words, Labour isn't working. Another six words, Britain's better off with the Conservatives. You don't need anything more intensive or analytical than that to actually demonstrate it's time to change, etc. Likewise, an awful lot of Mrs. Thatcher's techniques were applied by that young rock guitarist on the left-hand side. Cool Britannia, the development that obviously Blairite politics put together. And look, he's singing to whom? Who is this? It is Pudsey Bear. Would Pudsey Bear possibly sort of be a bad person to actually vote for? No, of course not. You know, so you're branding all sorts of other aspects within that, and again, coupled with that whole notion of new Labour, new Britain, new vision. Yeah, this is not quite, it is in your lifetimes, but you would have been nurseries and various other bits and pieces where you get that Cool Britannia that's coming through and developed. Simple images, effective marketing messages, put out, is it political spin?
Well, possibly.
Does it actually require more reflective and informed comment from undergraduates, postgraduates, journalistic students, and so on? Highly likely. But is it effective in terms of generating this kind of impact? Well, look at the results. And actually, I'm afraid that's what is often at the key elements of this whole way in which, in terms of comparative media histories, public relations will, just as Edward Bernays would, and Ivy Lee and so on, would use traditional media. This was a particularly historic cover of The Sun because prior to that, Rupert Murdoch's press had been staunchly Tory. Very much Tory. You know, the last person in Britain to turn out the lights if Neil Kinnock won the election day. One of the sort of lines were there. But interesting, their line, give change a chance. And probably still up to the present day in terms of national newspapers, red tops, broadsheets, tabloids, they still have an impact. The shift in terms of where we're going to, as I'll show you in a few moments, is very much to the social media and the way in which that's also working through that. Because all of these, in terms of media forms, have kind of had a good 100 years or so or more of actually working through that, with, of course, newspapers effectively balancing all of the various desires and choices, etc., on their backs and so on. And the super sore away Sun is, like it or loathe it, one of the key elements that was behind that whole thing. At the same time, as obviously it's run, or News International also look after the Times as well. Of course, the New York Times is run by whom? Who owns the New York Times? Well, actually, the Washington Post. Washington Post? Jeff Bezos. Who does Jeff Bezos not like? Donald Trump. Which friend of Donald Trump runs the National Enquirer? Well, he's a friend of Donald Trump, and I've forgotten him at present, but check that out. I'll set that as a task for you. And is it any surprise that the National Enquirer are running slander stories against Jeff Bezos? It's the way things operate. And obviously threatening to publish a whole range of things with respect to Bezos's broken marriage, his affairs, and so on and so forth. Yes, I'm afraid that cynicism is still alive and well when it comes to big money politics and indeed small time politics as well from that point of view. And it's partly a mixture of PR and other elements as well. So when we come to that, what about this game changer in social politics? Let's have a look at a lecture that, or at least a short lecture, a few introductions.
I'm Ken Rubin, and I just wanted to say a quick hello to the summer class at Penn State, studying persuasion, PR, and the masses. And I want to make really one very important point to start. For me, it's not about persuasion. It's about adding value. I like to say that we're going from a time when it was convince and convert to converse and convert, which means that we have to start thinking in a whole different way. Consumers are sharing, they're talking to each other. It used to be that somebody called customer service, they were initially always given a no because 70% of people hang up the phone, and all that the brand could see was the people they got off the phone and how they moved people much more quickly through the queue. But now we have to think about and realize that when people get off that phone call and they're told no, that they're doing something. Before they did it, we just weren't as aware. They were still doing it, just wasn't spreading as quickly. Now we've got social platforms that allow them to share that rigorously. And you have to think about that. So I want you guys, while you're working on this course this summer, to start thinking about PR in a whole different way. Normal PR and the problem I have with PR agencies and social, not PR agencies in general, I think when they do what they do best, they do a great job. But when they try to do social media, their culture and their DNA does not allow them to do it. Their culture is, their DNA and their culture is about less is more, controlling the message. And to me, social is the complete opposite. I don't want to control the message. I want to see where it's going to go. And I want to give more information, not less, so I can see what people are going to do with it. So start thinking about engaging, interacting, and how does a brand, when you think of yourself either as a personal brand or representing a brand, how do we add value and get people to engage and share with us? Remember something, and this is something that kills me all the time. You guys have heard about the changes in the algorithms of Facebook and the brands that are complaining. I look at them and they say, you know, hey, you had free rent for 4 years and now all of a sudden you've got to pay. Well, that sounds like a pretty good deal. The other side, and the reason I love the changes is because the people that are willing to work hard, experiment, test, and see what works and evolve their strategy daily are the ones that are succeeding. I'm getting more value out of Facebook than I ever got. So think about it this way. You guys are young, you're probably not working at major brands yet, but maybe you're an intern or talk to people at brands and ask them, how often did they go to the pages of the people who were their fans on Facebook, who like their pages, or the followers on Twitter? I guarantee you, almost no one's gonna raise their hand. They're gonna look at you quizzically. Well, you guys have probably all heard the expression, I'd love to be a fly on the wall in that meeting or during that discussion. Well, consumers today are inviting you into their living rooms and nobody's going. I'm going to leave you with two challenges. Number one, I want you to start visiting the pages of the people that follow you on Facebook and the people that follow you on Twitter. I want you to see what conversations they're having. Or better yet, go pick a brand. Everybody in the class, pick a brand. Or maybe one or two, or maybe three, and start seeing what their fans are talking about, what their followers are talking about, and then report back about it and see if you can come up with an idea of how better to engage them or things that they're interested in. And the second challenge I want to give you has to do with the way you communicate. So everybody knows what this is, I'm sure, right? It's an iPhone. Now, when I speak in front of audiences and I ask people, what is this? And I ask them, what's the biggest word in the iPhone? Invariably, everybody in the audience shouts out, I. But the biggest word is phone, okay? It's not just about you. So here's something I want you to do. Everybody has a smartphone, right? Well, they all come with apps. I'm sure all you guys have apps on your phones, but there's an app that comes on this, automatically installed, that most of you probably don't even know exists. It's got a keypad, and if you press 7 to 10 numbers, you can actually hear somebody's voice. It's remarkable. You don't have to use emoticons to express emotion. So I'm gonna give you guys a challenge. I know you don't like using it or hearing people's voices, but I want you to pick up the phone every day for the next 30 days and call somebody you haven't spoken to in a while and just say hello. Ask them, what can I do for you today? Or how can I help you? Just make it easy, make a quick phone call, and do it one day, every day this month, and see how it changes your relationship with those people.
There we are, I know. Radical stuff indeed. Using a telephone to actually make a telephone call. Outrageous. And the solution to the owner of the National Enquirer, which I've used my device to find out, David Pecker. Unforgettable name. David Pecker. He's the owner of the National Enquirer. Big fan and big friend of Donald Trump. Okay, let us move to the concluding sequence of this first sort of segment, which are some things to basically bear in mind from what I've been talking about over the last 53 minutes before you have a chance to talk, communicate, share something. Public relations and the brand is not new, okay? It's been going pretty much as long as we've had civilization, from those early Babylonian and Sumerian farmers and getting some indication in terms of how best to improve their lands. You're looking at similar kind of themes, similar ways in which those things have been developed. Everybody in this room is engaged in PR. If we weren't, we wouldn't bother about how we looked, we wouldn't check to look in the mirror, we wouldn't worry about what clothes we wore, blah, blah, blah. Everything is about image. A few weeks' time when you're actually doing your presentations, which we'll talk about next week, that's also partly image. It's partly working through the processes of elements within that. When you have your first job interview, it's PR, you're promoting yourself. Or third job interview, or 56th job interview, or however many interviews you actually have. It's still getting its brand Beth, its brand David, it's whatever line you're coming through. That's the message that's coming through. I've just mentioned the P word once or twice because I don't want to do spoilers. You know, I like to tease ahead and, you know, to send you off into reading week, I think. You know, don't reveal too much. So we'll talk more about propaganda and how that could be seen as problematic, but is nevertheless around with us, will be there. And why are we talking about public relations as a profession? Well, one of the characteristics it actually has is that it uses everything. It uses the social media, it uses the movies, it uses product placement in TV series, it uses radio ads, it uses billboards, it uses posters, blah, 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 it uses newspapers, etc., etc. And interesting enough, despite its global reach, and despite the fact that you see the same kind of techniques being used in China, in Russia, in India, in Brazil, in Venezuela, in many ways, actually the kind of fundamental things that we tend to look for still tend to have more of an American centricity to it, rightly or wrongly. It's the way things actually operate at present.